New Books in Geography, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Peter Ekman. I'm your host today. Today we're talking with Brian Tochterman, author of a very nice book called The Dying City, Postwar New York, and the Ideology of Fear. This book was put out last year, 2017, with the University of North Carolina Press in a series entitled Studies in United States Culture. And Brian comes to us today from Northland College in Wisconsin. How are you, Brian? How's everything over there?
I'm doing great, Peter. Thanks for having me on. Happy to talk about my book and to answer any questions that you have on it.
Of course.
Thanks for
making the time. Well, The Dying City is it's an intellectual and cultural history of one particular set of ideas that ends up establishing a pretty compelling through line through close to a half century of thought in and about New York City. The book starts around 1947, goes up to about 1985. In the epilogue, Tochterman points us towards the contemporary moment, and we hear a number of different voices, literary voices, voices from the world of planning theory and planning practice, other sorts of intellectuals, humanistic and social scientific critics of urban life, and a couple very compelling chapters on film and television and other forms of artistic representation. All of these voices taking up the question of what it might mean to say that a city is dying or might be about to die or has perhaps already died. We're just living amid its ruins. It's an intellectual history of urbanism, very nice analysis. It folds over 8 chapters, taking up what the author calls a set of spatial narratives, taking questions of urban representation seriously and asking sort of a second order of analysis how representations matter in politics, in culture, in everyday life. How representations endure and morph over time. Before we get into the substance of the chapters, I wonder if you could say a little bit about yourself, where you have come from, where you've been, geographically, intellectually, institutionally, and at some basic level, how you came to write this particular book.
Great, thank you, Peter. This book is a product, I would argue, of sort of personal and scholarly interests. So my background, I am a Midwesterner by birth. I actually grew up in Wisconsin, Green Bay, Wisconsin, to be exact. And after college, I wanted to work in the film industry, and I actually moved to New York because of that. I aspired, I guess, to work in film. That career path, for whatever reasons, didn't pan out, and I found myself working in the city of New York, working for the Parks Department in New York, actually. And I had a pretty spectacular job that involved having an office in Central Park, but also driving around the city and sort of getting to know the city all around the 5 boroughs there. And in that sense, I really got to understand the geography and spaces of New York in ways that not even people who live there their whole lives sort of get to see. But when I would return to my hometown or visit my parents, I'd often get questions about sort of danger and sort of fear about New York City. This was in the late 90s, early 2000s, at a time when, as New York still is, one of the safest cities in the country, certainly one of the largest and safest cities in the country. So I think at that point, that sort of planted a seed in my brain about, what is the origin of this image of the city? And certainly I had I probably carried those fears myself prior to ever visiting New York. You know, that was my probably my understanding of the city as this kind of exciting and alluring place, but also this place filled with crime and danger and those sorts of problems. Fast forward a couple of years, and via my work, I got interested in planning and geography. So I went to a master's program in urban planning. And I guess my aspiration had always been to work in sort of the history and theory of planning and development. And after I finished that degree, I moved on and decided to pursue a path in urban history at the University of Minnesota. Eventually, I got drawn back into New York via my research, and I really wanted to focus on New York in this era of urban renewal and demographic change and all these other sort of forces that are acting on the city in the post-war era that I initially did not plan on studying when I applied to graduate school or to my doctorate degree, but ultimately ended up studying. So, in that sense, this is really a project that where a lot of my sort of personal path and a lot of my personal interests and scholarly interests intersect in that respect. And ultimately, from film to literature to the intellectual history and planning theory, all of that has admittedly been an interest of mine and certainly a significant reason why it ends up as the key sources in this text.
Fantastic. Well, the book is organized chronologically. The first, it's really a set of four pairs of chapters. The first pair of chapters, bringing a couple of literary voices together, you set up a pretty strong conceptual contrast between what you call cosmopolis, on the one hand, it's more sort of optimistic vision of the city's possibilities, and on the other hand, necropolis, the city of death. And you exemplify these concepts through two particular authors, the essayist E.B. White, and on the other hand, the figure of Mickey Spillane. I wonder if you could say a little bit about what these concepts mean on the most basic level, and then, in a sense, how they endure, how they lend a certain kind of structure to discourse on New York over the next half century or so.
Yes, of course. Coming out of World War II, New York was at, I would argue, a turning point. It's, coming out of depression, coming out of war, and entering this atomic age where, despite the fact that the U.S. had the monopoly on the bomb at that time, it was only a matter of a couple of years before the U.S. itself would no longer possess that monopoly, and large, dense cities like New York would be prime targets for that new way of waging war and mass destruction. So E.B. White, recognizing the critical importance of New York, wrote what I would call a kind of foundational document on the place of New York City in the post-war era. And it's very brief. It was published in Holiday Magazine, but is now available in a standalone book. It has been for some time, called Here is New York, where he lays out a vision of New York that is historically grounded and forward thinking. And it's grounded in this image of the city as this entry point for immigrants and migrants for the over a century and a half that New York up to that point had existed, or I guess several centuries, I should say, going back to New Amsterdam.
Sure.
But White argued that it was the migrant and thus and not necessarily the native New Yorker or the commuter who gave New York City this special vibrancy, this special life. And that's really the sort of origin of my conception of cosmopolis sort of a symbol of a term that's I guess is used in planning theory to describe kind of this idyllic place of where difference is celebrated and diversity is celebrated, and sort of it's really only in large cities where that is sort of seen as possible. So for White, it was that image of this vibrant city made up of that continues to attract migrants and immigrants despite the forthcoming migrations out of the city to the suburbs, or the threats to the city by warfare or annihilation. It was important for White that migration into the city continued, and sort of that image of Cosmopolis he sought to sort of deploy to ensure the city's sustainability going forward. And I would argue that, I mean, that is an image that endures, but throughout the period that I'm talking about, it faces significant challenges, and I believe it gets drowned out in many ways. So that is a work of nonfiction. That is a work that analyzes New York in its contemporary state. And I believe it was appropriate representation of the city at that time. In the meantime, there are sort of fictional representations that are going to resonate later on, and that's where Mickey Spillane comes in. Mickey Spillane is a kind of transformative pulp writer, following in the footsteps of authors like Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, but with a variety of twists on the private detective and a protagonist of pulp fiction. His private detective is a sort of war veteran, and one who in the pages of his books operates not as a private detective for hire, but rather as a public vigilante who seeks vengeance upon various transgressions by the New Yorkers who populate the book. So these books, and in particular six novellas published between 1947 and 1952, are some of the most significant bestsellers of that era. I mean, I think they all populated the top 10 best-selling books of the 1950s or that era. So it was a narrative of a city that was in decline, in the throes of violence and decay, that reached a significant audience at that time. And it was, of course, a very sensationalist and exaggerated version of the city. But as I suggest in my book, it was one that would resonate with a variety of commentators down the line. Ultimately, I've labeled that image of the city that emerges out of Spillane necropolis, which is a term borrowed from planning theorist Patrick Geddes and his protege Lewis Mumford, mm-hmm. to mean the city of the dead. But I think it's appropriate description of the dying city that is present in Spillane and then later works.
Mumford appears here and there in the later chapters, of course, a New York-based or a New York-adjacent figure for much of his career, not all of it. That's fantastic. The contrast is very clear, and this terminology of cosmopolis and necropolis sort of orients the reader in diverse ways as the analysis moves ahead. I wonder if we could look at the next pair of chapters, which you indicate under the heading of Cancer and Death, New York Narratives in Planning Theory, 1953 to 1961. And one chapter apiece is devoted to arguably the most familiar figures in quite a number of New York-centric histories of planning and urban redevelopment, Robert Moses on the one hand, and his sort of standard antithesis and antagonist, on the other hand, Jane Jacobs. But you come at these figures in a slightly different way. I think you tap in to sort of a newer and more critical understanding of Jacobs's legacy. I think a more complex understanding of some of her intellectual influences and commitments. Also a more variegated understanding of her politics. You show, I think, compellingly some fairly strong affiliations between her her thinking and some strains in conservative thought, conservative political thought, and otherwise. That's interesting on its own merits. Your approach to Moses is also quite interesting. We know quite a bit about Moses's built work. We know about his signatures on the landscape in New York City and throughout the New York metropolitan region. But what you do that's really compelling here is you look at quite a number of Moses's own writings. You point out that the 1950s are a very particular moment in the landscape of media, a very particular age in the evolution of the American magazine, sort of an age of criticism. The book review has a certain kind of standing, a certain kind of purchase in public life. And so you look at quite a number of, I think, undercovered, underanalyzed writings by Moses himself. So I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on how your analysis differs from the sort of existing stories we have of Moses, Jacobs, and Moses v. Jacobs.
First off, let me say thank you for your appreciation of my reading of these two figures, because it is kind of an old saw when it comes to New York history in this period, and something that I recognized going into it. But I felt that within the context of my arguments, these two figures play a critical role. Just to talk about them in concert, they're both thinkers and theorists that are wrestling with these categories of cosmopolis versus necropolis, but they're using their visions are in contrast and their ends are in contrast, or they're sort of their means are in contrast as well, because they both see the city as dying, but they strive to sort of create or shape this cosmopolitan, or this image of cosmopolis, or this image of a new New York in the 1950s and the 1960s. With Moses, what's interesting about Moses, from my respect, is that, like Mickey Spillane, he aspired, and this is evident in some of his writings, he aspired to be a kind of pulp novelist. And his, I believe he actually wrote a pulp novel. I don't think it was ever published, but it's somewhere in his files and somewhere in his background. But he was a prolific writer, and he's a very skilled writer when it comes to sort of aggressive argumentation. And he used the magazine, which is going through this this sort of formative period in the 1950s and the age of criticism. He used that, the magazine article, to make the case for his urban renewal program. And he did that by deploying tropes from necropolis, particularly this metaphor of cancer, a cancer that required his skilled municipal surgeons and sort of bureaucratic modernism to remove that cancer. It also required a kind of wholesale cancer or removal of that cancer in this sort of large-scale municipal surgery. And so on the one hand, and other scholars have examined this, he has a very pictorial representation of decay and decline that he uses to make the case to municipal bureaucrats and others for the need for urban renewal. But for the public at large, he uses his sort of skill at writing and descriptions of the city as declining and as cancerous in order to get public support for his urban renewal program. Jacobs, on the other hand, as her most famous work illustrates, similarly deployed necropolis to her own ends. I mean, she talked about the death and life of great American cities, as the title says. So the image of death wrought by Moses's projects and modernism is very powerful in thus sort of changing the public perspective on modernism and urban renewal. And that sort of lively side, that vision of cosmopolis that she uses based on her own neighborhood in West Village, New York City, resonates through today, of course. Jacobs is continually celebrated as this kind of presenting this idyllic image of community, this idyllic image of how a city should work. The problem with that, as I try to highlight, is that it has a contingency for planning and for development, because it's this idea is picked up, this idea of the sort of living city, this organic city, is picked up by conservative commentators as an argument that, well, you know, that neighborhoods can do just fine on their own if we let them be. And that becomes a kind of barrier to more proactive social policy that really could get at the heart of what planning policy should tackle, like urban poverty, segregation, racial discrimination. It's this very sort of this sort of bottom-up lack of regulation image of how urban development happens is seized on by other commentators. The other issue with Jacobs is that she is dependent on presenting this, or her argument is dependent on presenting this image of the city as this kind of scary place where citizens have the right to fear because modernism has created these spaces that are dangerous. They don't have eyes on the street. They don't have this kind of self-policing mechanism that the neighborhoods that she loves and talks about possess. So, and it's actually a figure like Lewis Mumford who picks up on that and says, yeah, you know, Jacobs is right. And she has a reason to fear these cities. Mm-hmm. And it becomes an argument that is taken up by others and sort of becomes a kind of echo going forward.
Yeah, the eyes on the street figure or metaphor, so often cited, and you put a pretty distinctive spin on it, much more, you know, sort of surveillant understanding of what that notion is actually putting forth. And you spin the explicit or implicit politics of some of these ideas in a very, very different way, very surprising way. In the next pair of chapters, you are dealing with what you just you characterize as intellectuals in necropolis. Chapter 5 deals with a collection of intellectuals, a lot of the main figures that intellectual historians tend to have in mind when they invoke the New York intellectuals, capital I, those of what you describe as the old left, and figures like Irving Howe, Daniel Bell, Lionel Abel, and others. You convene these figures through one particular issue of the journal Dissent. Dissent put out an issue in 1961, which you point out was its best-selling issue yet, on the theme of New York City. And I wonder if you could think through one or two of these figures, what sorts of claims they are making about the city and the possibility of its death, and how this should, how the New York intellectuals' comments on New York itself should, I suppose, reorient how we think about their politics in a certain sense.
Okay, yes. So a lot of what I write about in that chapter is a comparison between that is found in the specific article in the summer of 1960, or sorry, the specific issue of Dissent from summer 1961, in which the critics and commentators all along, I would argue, sort of two guard, if you will, what you call it, the old guard and the vanguard, with respect to their vision of New York City. The old figures that I highlight, the old left and the old guard of the New York intellectuals that I talk about, as you mentioned, are Irving Howe. Daniel Bell is another key figure there, and a little bit lesser known intellectual named Lyle Abel, who it's one I would argue the most vicious Jeremy adds about Mark in that period, especially at the beginning of the 1960s. It isn't until the late 1960s where you have more overt attacks on maybe from local there. But what's interesting about the New York intellectuals at this time is they really, by the 1960s, are taking a nostalgic view about the city that says that the height of the city is not in its future, but in its past. And it's in its past when they were sort of more sort of popular figures in the New York intellectual milieu. So the typical someone like Irving Howe sees the 1930s, the 1940s as the pinnacle of the city. It was this place where intellectualism and sort of public intellectualism mattered, where they were taken seriously, and where they had kind of what Frederick Jameson calls universal access. They could move through the through Greenwich Village, which was their sort of home base, up through the city and into Harlem and area and sort of African American enclaves and working class enclaves throughout the city. They felt more comfortable in that milieu. By the 1960s, they see their sort of relevance fading, at least people like Howe. And I think that's what inspires him to write this remembrance of New York in the 1930s as a kind of popular memory of its glory days. Abel's piece, his Jeremy against New York in the 1960s, which is not does not refrain from sort of making overt criticisms of the demographic shifts that are occurring in the city at that time, including rising black migration and Puerto Rican migration to the city in the 1950s and 1960s. His piece is a sort of outright attack on the city and is kind of his breakaway from not just the city itself, but from that old left liberalism. He'd actually go on and follow a path of sort of the emergent new right at that time and would move from the pages of Dissent to the pages of the National Review, for instance. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you have a burgeoning group of new left thinkers sort of in the spirit of Jacobs. But writers like Michael Harrington, Dan Wakefield, all of them who, as the issue suggests, I mean, since it recognizes that New York is in a kind of state of crisis or emergent crisis, recognize that there's problems with the city, but want to address those problems or work to address those problems. Whereas the old left is sort of saying goodbye and good riddance and sort of farewell to New York as they knew it. And many of them would leave the city, at least for brief periods before coming back. So that's where the divide happens. It's those old left figures who, and this is, I think, a common issue with development in our own time. You have sort of older figures, you have sort of long-standing citizens who think that a place's past is the site of its best day, and that it's difficult to envision a better future for that place. And that is the position that these nostalgic old left figures like Howe, Abel, and also Daniel Bell, that's how they see the city in the early 1960s, whereas sort of emergent leftist figures like Michael Harrington are ready to see the city and recognize the problems of the city, but also want to work through a political and sort of grassroots lens to address those problems.
You catch this group of intellectuals at a very interesting moment. I mean, it's of course the case that a number of them, you know, began their lives as writers and as political actors somewhere on the left, and then themselves moved to the right. But you provide a certain degree of complexity. There are various varieties of left, various varieties of right here, and you're catching a number of these figures at this really interesting transitional moment, the early 60s. I think you described Bell himself as the transitional figure at some point, but it is profoundly a moment of transition. So you dig out these sort of untoward alliances between left and right, and I think you can clarify this, but I think you are presenting some of these old left, once left voices in Chapter 5 as sort of a preface to the more explicitly right-leaning voices that come to the fore in Chapter 6, the neoconservatives coming around ideas of the city's ungovernability, heavily in quotation marks. I wonder if we could turn to a few of those voices in the ensuing chapter. What does ungovernability mean? Who coins this term? What problems or perceived problems give rise to it, and is it a concept that is specific to New York City?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, I first off, let me say that I think you captured the summary of Chapter 5 in sort of excellent terms, and as you mentioned, Daniel Bell, I see as a key figure in this sort of transition, political transition that several New York intellectuals follow at this time, from sort of anti-Stalinism or sort of Trotskyist socialism to a kind of neoliberalism. Some go to neoconservative, some go to new right camps. And Daniel Bell, in defense, since I lumped him with the nostalgic figures of like Howe and Abel, he actually offers a more pragmatic understanding of the city in that dissent piece.
I agree.
Issue. So, but it is sort of a preface for his own sort of ideological change, even though he resists ideology and argues for pragmatism. The term ungovernability actually comes from another, or the ungovernable city actually comes from another key figure key intellectual that is drifting right at this time. And it's sociologist Nathan Glaser, who penned a famous book with Daniel Patrick Moynihan called Beyond the Melting Pot. He writes a piece in the earlier 1960s about New York City, published, I believe, I want to say in Commentary, called The Ungovernable City, that talks about the sort of growing public sector and municipal burden in the 1960s. And it actually becomes a kind of label attached to various mayoral administrations in the 1960s and 1970s, most notably that of John Lindsay, who faces a variety of strikes from sanitation to transportation in the 1960s. But it's figures like Glaser and figures like Irving Kristol and other new neoconservative commentators that are going to seize on the arguments of sort of new left intellectuals and other sort of representations of the city to sort of counteract any attempt to expand the welfare state or expand municipal services to aid people in need. So in chapter 6, I write a lot about Michael Harrington's famous study of poverty called The Other America, which is about a broader national story, but also focuses heavily on New York City based on his work with the Catholic Worker in places like the Bowery, which is New York's famous Skid Row, downtown New York's famous Skid Row, and in Harlem. And where he's talking about a kind of persistence of poverty in these neighborhoods that something like urban renewal has not addressed, and is thus thus argues that only a sort of reformulated public policy agenda can address those can address that problem. However, it's people like Glaser, or Moynihan, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and other sort of new right and neoconservative commentators who seize on the kind of tropes in Harrington's writing to and also some certain phrasing in Harrington's writing to condemn the victims of those poverty to a life of poverty. So some key phrases like the culture of poverty, which emerges from new left critiques and studies of poverty, like Harrington's, becomes ascribed to New York's poor and New York's racial minorities as a way to say it's futile to address these concerns because the culture is so deep and thus it's pathological. So another phrase is the tangle of pathology. That's Daniel Patrick Moynihan's term for the situation in places like Harlem, from Moynihan's famous memo on the Black family in the 1960s. So that's where this transition sort of continues from sort of leftist critiques, but also sort of reporting on the ungovernability of New York. That sort of that becomes the narrative that is seized by new right and neoconservative commentators in the 1960s.
Yeah, and I think very interestingly here, I mean, the concept of pathology, of course, coming from a medical discourse, and in a broader sense, you make the case that I suppose if we had been in the 50s or the age of criticism, the 60s in a sense, or this sort of age of social science. And there's this new purchase, a new visibility of social science in public through figures like David Riesman, C. Wright Mills, Kenneth Clark, Glaser and Moynihan themselves, John Kenneth Galbraith, and others. So there's this really really strong sense that there's the attempt to make these claims in not only a polemical register, but putting a certain kind of scientific precision behind them. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that's something that I would argue comes from Moses. I mean, it is, mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, you know, he's talking about the ailment of the city and the sort of the city is dying because it has cancer. At the cellular level, I mean, it's when it becomes sort of taken up by, other commentators, it's the result of this kind of pathology that is seen as inherent in those cells. I mean, meaning neighborhoods and individuals, who populate those neighborhoods. So, I mean, yes, what is striking, and hence the title of the book, is this kind of consistency across media, across commentators, who see the city as this organism and who see it as dying and ailing. It's really a kind of striking personification of the city.
And then you have a figure like
that is prevalent in this writing.
Yeah. Then you have a figure like Edward Banfield, explicitly conservative political scientist, writing towards the end of the 60s, mm-hmm. early 70s, who sort of breaks it wide open, saying that not only is not only are these pathologies uncurable, action is impossible. Even attaining really precise knowledge about the city as a social scientific problem is itself in question. Banfield, James Q. Wilson, some of these figures, you know, you'll read 200 pages of their stuff. This very, precise, all the trappings of, empirical social science. And then the last two paragraphs of the book, we know nothing. We can do nothing. We must do nothing. So the way we get from this sort of scientific impulse to this sort of political polemic, is fairly interesting at this point in time, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, from a planning and sort of a contemporary lens, it's an incredibly powerful narrative of the city, because when you look at something like public housing or other sort of social policies that have had its problems in the past, it's arguments like culture of poverty and pathology that prevent us from, sort of taking what we learned from that policy and sort of, or those policies and sort of perfecting those policies rather than, instead we get sort of arguments that, well, nothing can be done. It's just it's a futile effort to even try to address those problems, and that, in many respects, is the essence of a lot of our political discourse today. So, I mean, I feel comfortable drawing those lines anyways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We might now turn to the last pair of chapters. You have granted them the title Detour to Fun City, Cultural Responses to the Death of New York, 1967 to 1985. Quite a bit of attention to film, television, other visual and dramatic representations of the city from the mid to late 60s going forward. You point out that in 1966, under Lindsay, there's a pretty significant new policy shift with the city Office of Film and TV Production, such that quite a number of movies are being made in New York and about New York, from that moment going forward. By the 70s, the necropolitan image is pretty undeniable in a lot of these. Taxi Driver, canonically, and other such films. Death Wish with Charles Bronson. I think there are five of them, in fact, not all of them set in New York. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this moment. What new sorts of images are coming forth on screen during this period into the 70s, and how do they play out?
Yes, of course. So, yeah, there's a variety of policy and structural changes that are occurring in film in the late 1960s that result in a kind of image of New York in many respects, as others have termed it, Fear City in the 1970s. So on the one hand, as you mentioned, there's a push by Mayor John Lindsay to incentivize film production in New York City during the 1960s. You can see a kind of a qualitative difference between films produced on Hollywood sound stages but set in New York in the 50s and 60s, and those films later on that are shot on the streets of the city. So he incentivizes film in the city as a way, what he hopes is going to market what his vision of the city, which is a kind of Cosmopolis vision of the city he calls Fun City. That's exciting, alluring, and filled with harmless thrills. At the same time, in Hollywood, you have this change in sort of how films are made. You have this emergent period of bold experimentation. You have this new rating system that's going to allow for more graphic depictions of sex, more realistic language, and just this new sort of young filmmaking style that is going to push the boundaries of film as art. So those things come together in New York in the late 1960s and 1970s, and the films start taking up this image of the city that prior to that has been in these niche journals like Descent or in books like The Other America or in other sort of special investigative series by local newspapers, or high-profile crime events like the murder of Catherine Genovese in 1964, which shocked the city. This was a random rape and murder that really highlighted apathy in the city in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So film becomes the vehicle to sort of spread, broadcast this narrative of the dying city to a national audience in ways that a small-scale journal like Descent just could not do. And that's the sort of next step in the sort of evolution of this narrative of the dying city. So Death Wish, I would argue, is kind of the film par excellence, or the sort of necropolis film par excellence, but there are others that I talk about. Midnight Cowboy, The Out-of-Towners, Taxi Driver. All of these films sort of are engaging in these debates about not just New York City, but about the divide between city and suburb and sort of New York versus the Sun Belt and the West Coast. All to sort of create a kind of basically the antithesis of Lindsay's goal with that program.
So what goes on screen in Death Wish? Bronson is living on the Upper West Side, I think. I think he's a professor of some sort, and someone close to him is killed, and he just shifts into full vigilante mode. And then what?
Well, he's actually an architect.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
Which is even, and that is, that even makes it more pertinent to, this period. So he's an architect and he's designing these skyscrapers downtown, in downtown Manhattan. Until his wife and daughter are the victim of a home invasion, a random home invasion, by three, sort of gang members, one played by Jeff Goldblum, who, sort of get their names off a supermarket delivery slip. His wife ends up dead and his daughter is in a coma from, the rape and the assault. And what, Bronson's character realizes is that, or once he confronts the police admit that there's little chance of finding, the perpetrators of this attack because in the city, that's just the way it is, they say. So it's, it symbolizes that the city is, I mean, the police, are both overburdened, but they're also sort of ineffective in their police strategy. In order to clear his head, his architectural firm sends Bronson's character, Paul Kersey, to Tucson, Arizona, where he's been hired to design a suburban subdivision for this very sort of funny, I mean, not, he's not a funny person, but he's just a kind of contextually funny archetype of a kind of good old boy who loves guns and loves talking about the problems of New York City. So it creates this contrast of New York versus the Sun Belt, of city versus suburb, and sort of liberal gun laws versus sort of conceal carry laws. So what happens in Tucson is not just the sort of transformative work on the suburban development, but the developer takes Kersey to his gun club and treats him to some target practice and then sends him home with a gun as well. And that becomes his tool for becoming a proactive vigilante, sort of indiscriminately or indiscriminately killing sort of small time criminals, muggers, and other sorts of what would later be known as quality of life inconveniences in the streets of New York. So he's not out trying to capture his wife's killers. Rather, he's just doing the work that the police are supposed to be doing. And they're also, he's also doing it in a way that is, sort of supersedes due process, not unlike Mickey Spillane's, protagonist.
It's been a while since I've seen any of the five, in fact, but yeah, there is this sort of generalized other, the creeps, or the freaks, right? It's not sort of, due process pursuit of particular suspects, but something more, something broader, more diffuse, more, fearful than that.
I was just going to say, it's very, even though the attackers, the original attackers are, white, it becomes very racialized in his, sort of cleaning up of the city. And he faces no consequence other than being asked to leave the city, so he doesn't face justice because he becomes celebrated as a hero to citizens of New York.
So, all right. Well, in the final chapter, you bring in quite a number of other films from the later 70s into the 80s. You also take us towards take us into what you describe as the age of appropriation. You discuss the lure of decay and certain ways in which these once threatening, once repellent, perhaps, images of the city end up becoming their own kind of attraction, their own kind of commodity in a certain way. Pitch battles over questions of graffiti in 1970s and 1980s are remarkably intense. Figures like Nathan Glazer end up having quite a bit to say on this topic. In the interest of time, I think we can't necessarily do that chapter justice, but it does open on to the epilogue, and I think the broader through line of the book. I mean, you very compellingly trace the persistence and the mutation and the stubborn recurrence of this set of ideas about the dying or dead or nearly dead city across really quite an impressive range of discursive domains and historical periods. So in closing and kind of wrapping up here, I wonder if you could think a little bit about the extent to which this image is still with us today. Whatever is the first year of the contemporary moment, the 21st century or thereabouts, is this still utterly present in the same form as before, or is this underlying hunch and set of fears still in mutation?
Mm-hmm. It's certainly in mutation, and I think the categories. Well, certainly the prevalence of the categories and the strength of the categories, populous, certainly go under or undertake a shift in the 1980s and 1990s. And that's a lot of the final chapter is about it really. This narrative starts changing, and it has to do because of people recognize what happened in the city and the vacuum left by the wake of this narrative decline. But I suspect the image of the city of Necropolis is still, I mean, as my own personal experience relates, I mean, I still think, you know, for people who aren't familiar with places like New York, there's still this image of a kind of hostile, dangerous place and whatnot. But it really... the image of Cosmopolis has won out in many respects. The city is growing faster than it's ever grown, and it's larger than it's ever been. It is tied to significant growth in standard of living and sort of median income at this time. And development is occurring as well as sort of contingencies like displacement and gentrification in a lot of neighborhoods that would be unheard of in not just the 1970s and 1980s, but also in the early 2000s when I first moved there. So in that sense, and the city continues to attract in the spirit of bite significant migrants and immigrants from all over the world. With that said, whenever there's a kind of uptick in crime, you know, there's fears about New York falling into this, falling towards the bad old days. And I also think, and I've talked about this elsewhere, there is this image, a very powerful concern with a lot of longtime residents and citizens in New York that the city has been so successful in attracting sort of upper class migrants and immigrants and investors that it just has displaced the sort of vibrancy and allure of New York City. Has resulted in a lot of vacancies at the retail, at street level, sort of quote-unquote authentic places have been priced out and displaced. And in that sense, something a significant part of New York is dying or lost in that wave of development. And I find that a very powerful and convincing argument in that respect. But I do think the image of necropolis as a whole has shifted to other places. At the urban level, certainly Chicago is going through a sort of discursive necropolis period since President Trump has seized on that city as a kind of whistle. And certainly rural communities as well are perceived to be hollowing out or dying. And I sort of witnessed that firsthand since I live in a smaller city in a rural region. But I guess I would conclude by saying it gives me hope that that fate isn't necessarily foretold, given the experience of cities in the era of the urban crisis, where they were sort of written off and sort of left for dead.
So. Well, having published the book, you've probably had some time to formulate and move in the direction of something else. Can I ask you what you're working on now? Is there another book project in gestation?
Well, I would say a book project in gestation. I have had other responsibilities that have prevented me from digging deep into a new book project. But I am working on a book chapter related to representations of violence in cities as a whole, which is a nice escape from New York, because I can talk about other places where these representations occur. In the future, I want to stick around in kind of cultural history and development and urban history, and I have a sort of a seeds of a project that I'm thinking about in sports culture and development. So that's a literature I look forward to acquainting myself with in the near future.
Sounds great. So,
go ahead.
No. Go on.
Oh, I was just going to say that that is in the early stages, and but something I've been thinking about while I was putting together this book. So,
great. I look forward to
probably several years down the line.
I'm willing to wait. Look forward to seeing what comes of that. We've been talking with Brian Tochterman here, the author of The Dying City, Postwar New York and the Ideology of Fear. This is a book that came out just last year, 2017, with the University of North Carolina Press. I had a great time reading it. Brian has been very generous with his time, and thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, Peter, and thanks for reading the book, and I appreciate your analysis of it. It's obviously comprehensive, and you spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I'm happy to talk about it, so thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.